and welcome to another edition of Football Memories and Moments. I hope you're all well, and yet again, thank you very much for joining us and listening to us. It's fully appreciated, because quite literally, we wouldn't be heard if it wasn't for yourselves. This week, we're joined by Duncan Alexander. Duncan is from Opta. He's that person that gives you those brilliant stats that you can pass off on your own down to your mates in the pub who don't have Twitter. And he's also an author, Outside the Box, which is about statistical or statistics and statistical analysis. And also, he's written Opta's football yearbook as well. So, and it was great to catch up with Duncan, because he obviously deals with quite a lot of Premier League. He deals with high-end football, as it were, or I've probably annoyed all the lower leagues there, but I'm sorry. His memory is the promotion campaign that brought Wycombe Wanderers into the Football League for the first time under Martin O'Neill. And it was great to have a chat about that, because it's not really a level of football that we've touched. And it was something that I think instilled his love of football. And his memory is something for the Manchester City fans in the world. It's the Aguero goal that sealed Manchester City's first Premier League title in such dramatic form. You don't need me to tell you what that's about. So I hope you enjoy, and let's crack on.
So yeah, my memory is Wickham's 92-93 season, which was the year they went up from the Vauxhall Conference, as it was then, to the league, which had just changed to Division 3 that season, or as they went into it. They'd come very close the season before. They'd set a record number of points in the conference, but had unfortunately missed out to Colchester on goal difference. And more painfully, Colchester's, the fact they were level was because they'd won at Wycombe in the autumn with a goal from their goalkeeper in the last minute, which had bounced over our goalkeeper. So essentially that got them promoted, which still rankles, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I like Colchester that last 26 years, Duncan. I'm a big fan of that.
Yeah, essentially what football's built on, isn't it? So
Exactly. I mean, we can always remember, as an Everton, speaking as an Evertonian, we remember Clive Thomas from 3 years before I was actually born. So it's something that how it should be. I think that's the earliest reference to Everton I've ever got into the podcast as well. So I'm gonna rail that back. So were you an avid attendee this season? Was this your first real watching a football on a full term basis?
The season before was, really. I'd been going to Wycombe games with my granddad since the mid-80s, and luckily had coincided my childhood with Wycombe going from perennial also rams to appointing Martin O'Neill and moving to a new ground, which sort of all happened about the same time, same sort of year as Italia 90 and all that stuff as well. So it was a kind of, it almost felt like a kind of convergence of football magic into one. It almost felt like football was conspiring to just to please me, almost, which was good. And, you know, we went to Wembley 3 times in 4 seasons, and I kind of assumed this was just what being a football fan was like, and then obviously realised in the latter few decades that it's not the case.
I mean, I think you're the third person that we will have interviewed that, well, sorry, no, fourth if with David Squires, although his team has been in the Premier League, as has Andy Brassels, I suppose, but he's now an AFC Wimbledon, you know, he's gone down that route. And what is it like when you have these elements of success? And we'll go on, and very quickly, hopefully you'll talk in detail about the actual season itself. But what is it like being a supporter of a perceived smaller club when you have a year of success?
Yeah, well, I mean, sort of going back to my point a minute ago, that it felt at this time that we were, so I could have chosen, one of my granddads was a Chelsea fan and one was a Wycombe fan, and believe it or not, at the time, Wycombe was the sort of more glamorous option, because they were winning every week, they were, you know, they were the best non-league team in the country, whereas Chelsea were in their kind of, you know, electric fence, Ken Bates morass era. So it was kind of the glamour choice, but there was always this thing about getting into the league, you know, I mean, it's slightly you know, particularly now, people very glamorise or non-league football quite a lot. You know, there's non-league days on international weekends and stuff. But I always found that slightly bemusing, because when you're a fan of a non-league club, ultimately what you want to do is achieve success and get into the Football League and go as high as you possibly can. You know, Wickham moved to a new stadium in 1990, and with the kind of aim of finally getting into the league, you know, which they'd sort of come close to a couple of times. They could have joined the league before the war and chose not to for financial reasons. And there were kind of three big clubs really in non-league: the Oval, Wickham and Kettering, all of whom had the fan base to definitely support a league team. And obviously the Oval and Wickham have made it, and Kettering haven't. And, you know, they were the odd ones out really.
So that season itself, so just looking through, I mean, if I can understand that in all the football that you've watched, and you watch a lot of football, you analyse a lot of football, obviously, for your statistical role. But do you think you'll ever have... Wickham got promoted in this very season. You know, you've had some really good times again, albeit, you know, not as much, because you've also been through relegations as well, I suppose. So you're getting back to where you think you might belong. But looking at that season with the trophy and with the conference, what was that season like for you? If you take us through the whole season, if you can.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, you're right. I do consume a lot of football, but in a very kind of analytical way. And that's my job. And that's what I've, you know, made a career of, and et cetera. But I guess in some ways that might explain why this season speaks so much to me, because it was, you know, almost like the peak of childhood supporting football in a way. I was old enough, I was sort of 14-ish, I was old enough to, understand what was going on properly and remember the games and stuff, but young enough that it was literally, you know, I was literally waiting for Tuesday and Saturday every week, because it was, you know, pretty much the only thing that was going on in my life. So I think it holds that kind of almost sort of mystical nostalgia to it that I still think back on. And it's very different to you know, modern football in a lot of ways. To put it into context, obviously, as I said, we'd come very close the season before. There'd been arguments that Wickham should have gone up, because Maidstone had gone out of business, so the bottom tier in the Football League was going to be a team short. But I remember Jimmy Hill was quite vociferous in saying that you shouldn't bend the rules, and Wickham weren't going to go up, which again I never really forgave him for. But there was a little bit of hesitation going into 92-93. I think, you know, some people worried that the team might, have a hangover from the previous season. But they started off with, I think, winning nine of the first 10 games. The end of that run being a 4-0 away win at Kettering, who were, you know, seen as one of the main rivals. They were playing pretty scintillating football. People like Steve Guppy on the wing, Keith Scott, who I heard David Squires mention. Swindon signed him from Wickham the following season. But, I mean, he possibly wasn't the greatest striker the Premier League's ever seen, but he was one of the best strikers the conference has ever seen. He was pretty much unplayable. People like Dave Carroll, Keith Ryan, who stayed with the club for another decade after we went up and was still playing for Wickham in the FA Cup run, and obviously scored in the semi-final against Liverpool. So, you know, it was a really solid team. And I think the thing to remember as well is that they were part-time. So the season before, they'd gone toe-to-toe with Colchester, who were a professional team. And Wickham players, even that season and this season, trained two nights a week, and that was it. So, you know, they all had proper jobs. The captain, in fact, was injured for the second half of the season, because he worked in a factory in Milton Keynes, and someone ran over his foot with a forklift truck. And kind of really badly damaged his Achilles, so he was out for half the season. So that's, you know, not an injury that most footballers nowadays would be at risk from, I imagine.
Your day job, as you're saying, is at Opta, and you're very high up at Opta, and every now and then Opta does throw out tweets about some of the more ridiculous things about football. So in your opinion, which is the more bizarre injury, that or Dave Pheasant? Ironically, in the news this week with the change from salad cream to whatever, it's a sandwich cream as it's now going to be called. What was the more bizarre injury for you? Around about the same time as well.
Yeah. Well, I think in terms of bizarreness, you'd probably still go with Bessant just because of the precision of the stuff. I mean, it wasn't Santi Cañizares did it with Cologne, which struck me as a much more continental, stylish way of doing it. So, but
bloody foreigners, eh? But coming back to the season and looking through the manager was Martin O'Neill.
And yeah.
Do you think this season, was it this season or the next season where Wickham were promoted again? Which you think did you think forged his reputation as a manager, because he was able to show that he wasn't just doing it with at that level, but he was able to go on and do another level. But do you think this season forged his reputation a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the thing to remember at the end of the season, he was approached by Nottingham Forest, who obviously it was the first Premier League season as well, and they'd you know, Brian Clough had retired and Forest had gone down to what's now the Championship. You know, O'Neill was, I think, overwhelmingly the fans' choice to take over because he had made such a name for himself with Wickham. And to everyone's surprise, mine particularly, he turned Forest down to stay with Wickham. And it worked out because, you know, that season we went up again to what is now League One. And then that season, it was only because the Premier League was being reduced from 22 to 20 teams that we didn't get in the playoffs the following season, because we came sixth, you know, toe-to-toe with teams like Birmingham. Teams that you'd never have imagined us even playing a few years ago before. And we came sixth, and you know, normally that would have been a playoff spot, but that year it was one team went up directly and then second to fifth was in the playoffs. So he basically had four or five seasons at Wickham where he basically did no wrong. And you know, every season his kind of reputation got bigger and bigger. And then obviously in the summer of 95, he finally left to go to Norwich and then didn't last there very long before going to Leicester, where he pretty much did for Leicester what he'd done for Wickham.
What, just interesting though, Duncan, why choose this season over 93-94? What's so special about 92-93 for you?
I could have chosen either, to be honest. I think 93-94 was good, but I think this season, just the fact that they were a part-time team and it was kind of like the culmination of, I think, I'm not 100% sure, I think Wickham were the last part-time team to win the conference. So it was, that, you know, that's an achievement in itself. And it was just the fact that they did the non-league double, they won the league by a long way. And, you know, it was just, there were so many little good stories throughout the season as well. You know, I mean, to talk about the part-timeness of the players, I remember the door, our front door, I didn't live that near Wickham, I lived about an hour away. There was a knock at the front door one evening after school, and I opened the door, and it was Wickham reserve striker Dennis Green selling fish door to door. And I had just come home from school, and had a Wickham scarf around my neck, it was winter, and he kind of looked utterly aghast. I think he'd gone a long way away from Wickham to sell this fish because he didn't want to bump into any Wickham fans. And I remember, like, stammering, going, oh my, you know, there's a Wickham striker at my door trying to sell me haddock or something. And getting really, and then obviously having no jurisdiction to buy fish, then going up, finding my mum and saying, there's a Wickham place trying to sell fish. And after she'd grasped the concept, she was like, well, we should buy some of his fish. So I went back outside and I couldn't find him. And it was this kind of bizarre, I spent like half an hour walking around the streets looking for a Wickham player selling fish. And it was, yeah, you don't really get that nowadays in football. And it was little things like that, really, that just make that team quite memorable.
Were you on any strong medication as a child, Duncan? I'm just I feel compelled to ask that.
Cod liver oil, no.
Fantastic. But,
yeah. And the other thing as well, having looked back through the season, so Martin O'Neill has a particular reputation now with fans, and, you know, Aston Villa fans don't really like him, Sunderland fans aren't convinced. You know, Leicester and Wickham, he's pretty much a god at those two clubs. And he, you know, he's got a reputation for playing quite functional football, which may be true in his latter days as a manager. But at Wickham, I mean, we did have the advantage. You know, we were a well-supported team. He didn't ever struggle to buy players at that time. But they played really good football. You know, Steve Guppy was pretty much unplayable in that context. And you know, he was a very entertaining man. And he also, he had this program notes column, which obviously most managers do in programs even now, but he used to use it as this kind of ranting soapbox. So he, this is obviously pre-internet, so people would write letters, and I'm sure every club around the country, around the world, has got its own proportion of fans that nothing is good enough. You know, even when you're winning the league and winning cups, they're still complaining. And he used to, rather than just ignore these letters, he used to read them all and then respond to them in his programme notes. So he, every week or every home game, you would read, you know, some guy from wherever down the road had written in saying, you know, I'm disappointed with Keith Scott's perform at the moment. And O'Neill would just lay into them. And sometimes he'd have a go at, I remember one time, he was having a go at Michael Parkinson, who'd been in the paper saying that modern footballers, i.e. 1990s, you know, were divers and cheats. And O'Neill sort of flew in at him. And it was, you know, genuinely entertaining, but in a way that would never, in this current sort of very media-managed world we live in, you can't imagine a manager really doing that.
I mean, that's the thing, is that you can't really imagine many managers actually writing their own programme notes, aren't they? It's, you know, some clubs might have a media manager who's trusted to write the notes, or it's a quick 5-minute interview with the boss, and then someone else goes and types them up, isn't it? So, do you think that because of that level of intelligence he had, level of you know, it's famous that he was in the front row of the Barry George Gil Dando trial and the retrial, I think, as well.
Yeah.
Do you think that gave him an advantage over being able to outthink teams? But and also just the other aspect I wanted to talk about he, while you were talking there, I counted up in that season, you scored in victories 4 goals or more 10 times in the course of the league season. I mean, that's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, as I said, they were comfortable winners in a lot of games. You could just tell it was, I don't know if you've ever been around him, but he's a very kind of, you know, almost fiercely intelligent man. He's a very impressive person when he talks. He really captivates. You can, you know, there were all stories throughout his career that he doesn't actually do much on the training pitch, but will come in, you know, and give the team a team talk, and that's what he does. And you can, you know, he is, without resorting to cliche, he is the sort of man you can imagine following into battle, and it certainly worked with Wickham, and I think possibly even more so given the fact that they were part-time, you know, so he didn't see the players every day. He saw them, you know, a couple of times a week, and then whenever they had a game. And so, you know, Pep Guardiola, for instance, that his methods would not be that effective in that kind of environment. But I think they really did kind of, you know, O'Neill's ability was brought out even more so.
The season there, you're looking at, I mean, it's for me, I don't know if you've ever grown up, I don't know what age you are, Duncan Ram. When this comes out, I'd be 38, and one of the games that I grew up playing was multiplayer soccer manager on the Amstrad C64.
Yeah.
And the irony is, I think that Wickham are sponsored by Football Manager, aren't they? Now.
Not currently. They have had FIFA for a bit, but yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. The looking at some of the teams that you've played here, because you had to start at the bottom, and it's bringing back memories of some of the teams that you had to play in, and the teams that you had to play here, and that's kind of, does that add to the nostalgia that you've seen some old-fashioned non-league names? I'm talking Runcorn, I'm talking Sutton United, who obviously still in the league, Northwich Victoria, was the other one, Dagenham and Redbridge, Gateshead, who obviously still aside now. But does that add to the nostalgia that they're teams that you recognise and acknowledge?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you look at the conference now, it's very similar to League Two in a sense. You know, there's a lot of clubs in there that have gone down, and you've got to remember at this time it had only been 10 years or so less than 10 years of automatic promotion from the conference to the Football League, and so the teams in there, as Colchester had gone up the season before, as you say, pretty much wall-to-wall classic non-league teams. And it was, you know, it felt kind of weird playing some of them, thinking we might never play them again. I mean, Altrincham, you know, another big name in non-league history, I don't think Wickham have ever played them after April in 93, and you know they've had tough times just as Kettering have.
And they've bounced back this year. I think actually also them back into the Conference North. I went to see them 2 years ago at Chester. But it's great. And so what were the highlights of the season then? What was the thing? What the games that stand out to you for that year?
So the falling at Kettering in the autumn was when I thought we're going to win the league by miles, because as I said, I think it was the ninth win in a row, so 9 out of 10 in the start of the season, which is a good way to start. Moving to December, we played West Brom in the second round of the FA Cup, which was shown on Sky, so that was like a massive excitement, and obviously the first time Wickham had ever been on a live TV game. And we went 2-0 down in the first half to Aussie Ardiles at West Brom and came back to draw 2-2. Probably deserved to win, really. But I mean, I remember O'Neill saying at the end of that game that the directors were hugging themselves at getting a 2-2. So we got a replay at the Hawthorns, which my dad drove me and my mate to and left way too late. So we missed the first half an hour, which was a very stressful experience. Lost 1-0, but again played really well, and that was live on Sky as well. And it was it all built into this kind of idea of Wickham as this sort of transitioning force from non-league football to professional football. And you know, outside Buckinghamshire, it might not have been making that much of an impact, but it was definitely a big story. And then basically, the second half of the season was just multi-fronts really. So we were in the FA Trophy, we were in this competition called the Drinkwise Cup, which is essentially like a league cup for conference teams, but no one really took it seriously. But we got to the final and lost, so we could have done a treble in our last season, but we didn't. But yeah, you know, so it was basically just every week was exciting, and every week was a big game that they seemed to do well in. And even despite a pretty bad injury crisis, I mean, I mentioned the Glyn Creaser, the captain, who hurt his foot with a forklift truck, but there were loads of others as well. And O'Neill had this knack of bringing in players who, like, whether it was favours or just random players who didn't even look that good, but he managed to get them to do a sort of 7 out of 10 performance. So we took this guy called Trevor Aylott, who had played for Palace and Chelsea previously, but he was really at the end of his career. Very overweight, very possibly the most immobile footballer I've ever seen. I mean, made John Parkin look like Neymar. And he couldn't move, but he would occupy a couple of defenders. And, you know, he didn't play in any important games, but, you know, it turned out, particularly towards the end of the season, where we had almost ridiculous fixture congestion as well. So we played on April the 3rd, April the 6th, April the 10th, April the 13th, the 15th, the 17th, the 18th, the 20th, the 24th, the 27th and the 29th. And if you think they're, you know, part-time footballers, that is a lot of games in a few weeks.
Did O'Neill ever turn out in any of these games? Because he was only really coming to the end of his career, wasn't he? Or he was only a couple of years post-career. Did he sign on as a player?
No, he never did. I think we had like an exhibition game and we left our old ground in 1990 with George Best played. And I think he might have come on for a few minutes in that, but he did his knee quite badly towards the end of his career. So, he wasn't anywhere close to, unlike Ainsworth now, he still occasionally names himself on the bench when he has to. So, and I mean, I guess the other kind of aspect of the season was we had been the team that was pushing us for most of the season. Well, bizarrely, they only ended up finishing fifth, but they were second for most of the season, was Slough, who geographically, if nothing else, are Wickham's closest rivals. You know, Slough and Wickham were probably, you know, 12, 15 miles apart. So yeah, that added like a sort of local edge to it. And the home game with them, which was scheduled for the winter, got postponed due to weather, I think. And that was end of March. We played them at home, and the attendance was 7,230, which is pretty good for a non-league game. And it was a complete sellout. And in those days, Wickham's ground, there was some woods behind the one of the stands, and basically there was probably about 200 or 300 people in the woods, hanging out trees and just watching. It was like the most you know, 70% terracing as well, and it was absolutely rammed, and it was, you know, it was a sort of atmosphere that as a young kid I was pretty swept up by.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it, that it's the kind of atmosphere that you adore. The I was going to say something like that might be Slough people living in the woods actually coming out. I'll hear nothing bad said about Slough. It was the it was my first ever journalistic job, and considering it's an absolute mental, it's a very, very strange place, I utterly adore it. And it's good to see them having a bit of a resurgence football wise as well.
Yeah,
and that's the thing. Some of the attendances here are incredible, aren't they? And particularly for the home game. So Wickham were averaging around about 4,500. Was that?
Yeah, that was. I mean, so before we moved to Adams Park, we used to average about 2,000. Then it slowly sort of crept up during the O'Neill years, and then I think his final season we averaged nearly 6,000 when we were in equivalent of League One. Obviously helped by having teams like Birmingham and Huddersfield bringing a lot of fans, but you know, the support, regular support, basically sort of doubled or trebled over half a decade, and it's sort of stayed with them ever since. You know, they don't get particularly more now, or they don't get more now. They get about, you know, 4,000 on average. So, you know, a lot of those people hung around, and it's possibly been harder to attract new fans in the sort of years of struggle and since.
What was the day out at Wembley like? I'm assuming you went.
Yeah.
On the 9th of May, what was that like? Is that as a young fan, was that your first experience at Wembley?
No, because we had got to the trophy final 2 years previously and won as well, which was kind of like the first of O'Neill's achievements, really. And you think we won the playoffs in 94, so that, yeah, three wins at Wembley in 4 years. And I was like, well, this is, you know, standard. And, you know, it took us 20-odd years to get back there. So appreciate what you have at the time is the moral there. Yeah, I mean, it was funny because we beat Runcorn at home in April to basically mathematically secure the title. I think Slough could have still caught some goal difference, but we basically got a draw at Slough. 2 days later, home to Runcorn, won 5-1. Steve Guppy scored a brilliant goal to make it 4-1, ran the length of the pitch and then dinked it over the keeper, which was, you know, kind of like the picture-perfect way to seal the title. So they lost 5-1 then, and then we beat them 4-1 in the trophy final. So it did feel a bit bad for them, particularly as I think Wickham took about 24,000 fans to Wembley. Obviously, it's really close to Wembley, possibly one of the easiest clubs. You know, Wembley's one of the easiest places to get to compared to other clubs. And Runcorn probably had, I don't know, 3,500. So they were kind of out from the start, really. And Wickham scored after a couple of minutes. Jason Cousins scored a free kick, which he then proceeded to kind of run over, jump the advertising hoardings, climb up the fence, and stewards were trying to pull him down. And he was, I think, kicked one in the face, which was amusing at the time, but I hope the stewards are right. But yeah, it never really felt in doubt. It was a kind of, every fan, well, hopefully every fan of every club, will, some more than others, will have those seasons where you just feel like everything's falling into place. And it was kind of like the final bit of that, really. In some ways, it was, of the three trips to Wembley in those 4 years, it was the least memorable, in the sense that in 91, you know, winning it was massive for the club. You know, hadn't won a big trophy for so long. In 94, going up, again, we beat Preston, who were a big club and had more fans than us. And that felt like a real kind of win against the odds. Whereas this one was a bit, you know, almost a bit, you know, run-of-the-mill. So the moment I'm going for, in a bit of a switch from non-league memories, is Sergio Aguero's title-winning goal for Man City in 2012 when they beat QPR, which I doubt there's many people who don't know about this goal, but if you don't, then City had been, you know, looked like they were going to win the title for most of the season, then had a almighty collapse in the spring, United had overtaken them and looked, you know, nailed on to win another league. And then in a bizarre set of circumstances, Everton, in fact, obviously got that 4-4 draw at United, and City just beat them as well, pegged them back. And so basically it overtaken them on goal difference with a week to go. So basically they just needed to win. On the final day of the season, they'd been, you know, almost unplayable at home. They were playing QPR, who I think that season had one of the worst ever away records in Premier League history. You know, it was, no one foresaw any issues at all, but that's not how it transpired. And I'm particularly averse to fans of clubs, certain clubs, who kind of think that bad luck befalls them more than others. So Tottenham fans are particularly bad at, you know, every time they let in a late goal or do something like that, they'll be like, well, that's typical Spurs. And it's like, well, it's not, because it happens to every club, you know, some more than even your club. But, you know, for City fans that day, I imagine that as they saw QPR winning 2-1 and the title slipping out of their hands, thought, well, this is just, you know, what it feels like to be a Man City fan. But lo and behold, game went into injury time. Edin Dzeko, who I still reckon is the most underrated player in Premier League history, he equalised, header. And then in the, what was it, 95th minute or 94th minute, Aguero popped up with, you know, one of the most iconic goals in English football history, really.
And that's a fairly good summary, I think, if people hadn't seen it. But also it's a nice refresh for people who had seen it. And it is, you know, when they talk about the Premier League, I think it's okay to talk about the Premier League and still remember that football started before 1992. I know that there's a lot of people who are not in favour of who are almost militant about remembering that there's football before 1992. But it is one of the greatest moments, because of, I think, something you've alluded to, is City fans who will listen to this will tell you that, like there is for Everton, there is something ingrained in City that to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, and that 2 minutes before was basically that, wasn't it? That City were on the verge of the biggest mental collapse in sport that I think you could have ever had.
Yeah, I mean, it was just inconceivable that it could even happen. And United were away at Sunderland and they'd done what they needed to do. They'd won the game, their match had finished, and there's obviously those shots of the United fans celebrating, the players kind of half celebrating, but just milling around on the pitch waiting for the City game to finish, you know, obviously stunned that QPR, well, presumably at that point it was 2-2. And, it, you know, it was kind of a very televisual moment. You know, we'd come a long way from the early years in the Premier League and to this point in terms of kind of TV production and stuff. And, you know, it was the fact that Sky was showing both games and you could cut between them. You know, I was working that day and I remember everyone just stopped what they were doing. And that sort of 4 or 5 minutes of injury time at the Etihad was like, no one spoke. It was just, you know, you just wanted to see what was going to happen. And there's just so many things about that game that just stand out. It's, you know, Joey Barton got sent off. And then they started having a fight after, you know, as he was walking off the pitch. Obviously a former City player. You know, City had 44 shots in that match, which is the most Opta have ever recorded in a single Premier League match. I mean, Joe Hart took multiple throw-ins in that game, which I think is the only time that's ever happened, purely because City were camped in QPR's half. So if the QPR cleared it, you know, down the other end of the field and it went out for a throw, Hart was just running out and taking the throw-in. And possibly the best angle to it as well is that the player who played the ball in to Aguero to score was Balotelli, and he only ever assisted one goal in the Premier League, and that was the one.
If a football club was writing a manual for a season, not how not to win the league, or how to win the league by causing the absolute most stress anyone can to a manager's players and fans, that would be the manual for that season, wouldn't it? Because of the way that season worked out for City.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there'd been obviously a coming force the couple of seasons beforehand, and they're very much, I think they went into that season possibly favourites. United had won the league the year before, but not in a very memorable way. It was a bit of a kind of post-Ronaldo slump in terms of, you know, excitement. But yeah, City, they, yeah, it was just, it kind of, you wonder what would have happened if they hadn't have won that game, because, you know, obviously they didn't win the league the following season, and they did win it the year after. They, it was very much overshadowed by Liverpool's kind of season that year. So, you know, it was very important for them to get that win on the board. You know, you look at like PSG, for instance, who are desperate to win the Champions League, and they're not really getting that close yet. And it's similar with City in the Premier League, I think. You know, if they'd have failed that year, it could have had, you know, long-lasting psychological effects.
The season itself, I mean, that moment is a microcosm of City's season, where they had all that talent and they had contributing parts, but ultimately, in that time, in that period, they were carried largely by Aguero's brilliance, weren't they?
Yeah, I think him and Yaya Toure was particularly good in that run-in, as he was 2 years later as well. He almost, I remember, they won at Newcastle the week before the final game, and he was outstanding in that game. So, that, you know, it was almost like the two, possibly the two big names that they'd brought in at the start of the decade. Or obviously that was Aguero's first season, but, you know, they'd started to be able to attract these players. And it was one of those examples of those players, you know, genuinely earning their keep. Because, I mean, the thing with, you watch that Aguero goal, is it's such a cool finish. You know, it comes to him, he doesn't hit it immediately. He kind of drops his shoulder slightly, which commits the defender, and then he just rifles it in. I mean, it just, you know, there's no chance it's not going in. And then it's made even better. Obviously, there's the iconic Martin Tyler commentary, the elongated Aguero. But if you want to see some good angles, if you search on YouTube, there's loads of fan footage from the game. And there's one that's particularly good, because it's the other end of the pitch, and it's like 2 minutes leading up to that goal. So it must have just been after Deco equalised. And the tension in the crowd, you can just hear some people, you know, shouting, come on, City. You can hear some people just almost in tears, and people kicking seats. And you know what's coming. You can see the ball, like, work its way. And then there's just this kind of explosion of joy, which, you know, obviously I'm not a Manchester City fan, but you can't help but, I mean, I'm sure even some Man United fans would get swept up by that, because it is, you know, they're the moments that everyone watches football for, really. And everyone knows, it doesn't matter if you're Man City with loads of money, or you're Everton, or you're Wickham, or whoever, you know, they only come along every few decades. And you know, what, I guess the Aguero one is possibly the first one that's happened in an era where people can, you know, have their own recordings of it. I mean, imagine if we'd had Arsenal fans with filming Michael Thomas's goal at Anfield in '89 from, you know, behind the goal. You know, that would be equally iconic. But yeah, I guess it's kind of like a technological milestone.
I mean, a couple of things there. While you were talking, I've dived onto YouTube and I've watched that fan footage, and I know what you mean. And the most incredible thing about it is that QPR actually have the chance to get out about a minute and a half before the goal, and they don't take it. And in the fan footage, you can see, can't you, that the remaining 20 players outside of Joe Hart, who is near enough in shot, but they're all in shot of that fan's phone. Now, bear in mind that a fan's iPhone is not the same as a you know, state-of-the-art Sky TV camera, but you can see all 20 players in the same area, and that says a lot for the brilliance of the goal, really, doesn't it? Because there's a lot of bodies in the way.
And yeah,
it takes Balotelli, actually, you know, in my head I always thought that Balotelli rolls the ball to Aguero, but he doesn't. He basically tackles the ball to Aguero.
Yeah, well, it was, in a sense, you know, he wasn't a man who liked to dole out assists, as we found out. So, I mean, yeah, you're right, it's almost like a lunge that finds its way to Aguero. But yeah, I mean, it's just, yeah, I don't know. It's just one of those moments that really resonates, I think. And it's, I guess, one of the moments that, you know, enhances the Premier League around the world as well. You know, it's, you know, I was trying to think of similar ones in other countries. There was obviously Rivaldo's overhead kick to get Barcelona into the Champions League sort of a decade or so ago. That was equally kind of dramatic, although it was only qualification for the Champions League as opposed to league titles. And, you know, these kind of, these special moments are kind of what draw new fans to the sport, I guess.
As much as I really don't want to admit to it, and you're talking about what the technology been like had when Michael Thomas scored. Obviously, I would have loved to have seen that. but it's an interesting season, isn't it? Because because City's season was on the verge of imploding, particularly with Tevez, and Tevez. I think it's unforgotten, really, isn't it, that Tevez's is role, where Mancini actually shows that he can be pragmatic about putting that whole thing, because Tevez came back towards the end of the season and played a crucial part in actually City winning the league. And do you think that sometimes gets forgotten?
Yeah, I think, you know, he had a difficult relationship, but most of his clubs really, and obviously had switched to City from United. So he was he's the sort of player that's always loved by fans and less so by managers, I think. But yeah, I mean, Mancini, again, from all accounts, a difficult man, but you know, what he did was very impressive. You know, there's not many managers who outfought Alex Ferguson in his time at Manchester United. And, you know, there were always these reports that Ferguson was genuinely kind of worried about Mancini in a way that he never had been with Arsene Wenger, for instance. So, you know, to get that many points in a season is obviously a team effort. And, yeah, it was the classic thing, isn't it? If you start a season badly and come good, everyone thinks fondly of that season. City did the reverse, in a sense that, you know, they started very well and then had their blip in the spring, which, you know, worked out in the end. But if it hadn't, then that would have obviously had, you know, a longer lasting effect.
The other mad aspect of the game is not so much from a City point of view, is it? But Gibril Cissé, in his most Mr. T mode, also scored a fairly cracking goal as well, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, that was the quality of QPR's two goals were really good. And, you know, Joe Hart looked pretty stunned after both of them. And, it's kind of quite... There's this thing in certain countries, like Italy in particular, where, you know, although QPR weren't technically safe, there was, you know, the idea that a smaller club would have the temerity to you know, spoil the party would be seen as quite odd. But, you know, whether it's true or not, the kind of English football thing of, you know, every team tries its hardest in every game sort of thing. You know, that never has there been a better example of that, really. You know, QPR are a team that had struggled nearly all the season, but had probably their best performance, at least for the first half anyway, in there. And obviously went down to 10 men with that Joey Barton meltdown.
Who could have been sent off for a number of things in the incident itself. The elbow, the boot, and Aguero. I've watched it a couple of times in preparation, and there are some utterly bizarre things that happen. And is that part of why football is great? I mean, you look at football from such an analytical perspective. Do you remember sometimes to look at football in the utmost bizarre? For example, Joe Hart for the second goal. I can't remember who scored it. Jamie Mackey, that's it. Joe Hart seems to have a broken C button on his controller when when the header goes in. Julian Lescott doesn't know what day it is. For the header. So do you is it games like this that remind you to sometimes step away from the analytical aspect of your footballing love to go back to the absolutely batshit mental side of it?
Yeah, I think, and that's something you always have to, you know, make sure you do that as well, because I think one of the reasons Opta is generally well regarded is because it's clearly, you know, the people that do stuff are football fans first and foremost. You know, when I've recruited people, I've always looked for people who love football, because, you know, I could look at data and statistics around something I don't know about and I wouldn't have an idea of what was good and what was bad. You know, you have to understand what makes football interesting and brilliant. And, you know, if the raw data of that game would be, you know, Aguero winning goal, that, you know, that, but he probably did four or five times that season. But, you know, put it into context, and particularly in the game, and it's that kind of marrying together of football history and love of the sport with a kind of with more information. So the fact that you can, you know, you can pull out stuff like that, that City have 44 shots, which is the most in a Premier League game ever recorded by Opta, you know, that's just additional information which only adds into the narrative of the match. And it's making sure that the data helps the story rather than is the story.
And that, yeah, I kind of know what you mean, is that it's when you, it's the aspect of when you're celebrating afterwards, and you don't really remember the because of the emotional side of it. And when you start to build your understanding, your knowledge of it, when you start finding out, like, you know, that's, as you said, that's the first time Balotelli had assisted all season, and it was in the most un-Balotelli way that you could expect, and that's something. I'm going to ask you an unfair question as we hail towards the finish, but Martin Tyler's most famous commentary at the time was, "I swear you'll never see anything better than this," or, you know, a paraphrase and such like. Do you think we will? Do you think that is, in terms of the Premier League era? I still don't think, personally, in my own opinion, I don't think it's better than Arsenal Liverpool, which now I think you have to take as an independent thing and out of context of how it is. In terms of 90 minutes shootout for a league title, you know, obviously the surrounding context of it. I don't think we can talk about that here, but in other elements we would. Do you think that will ever be beaten as a Premier League finish?
In that context, probably not. I think the Premier League's only come down to the last day, probably six or seven times in the history of it. I mean, everyone can remember the Guerra, as you said, Michael Thomas. There's not many other ones in the history of football. So, yeah, in terms of the, as I was saying, in terms of the kind of coverage, in terms of the kind of impact that made, you know, it was, what were we, sort of 2 or 3 years into Twitter being a thing. And it was just, I mean, obviously the fewer GIFs, I imagine, flying around in May 2012, but it was the first kind of like, wow, did you see that moment? And for that reason alone, I think it will, you know, it will live on.
Well, thank you very much for that, Duncan. It was a great chat. Really did appreciate it. And I hope everyone who listened to did as well. You can find Duncan at Oily Sailor on Twitter, or just by searching his name. And from there, you'll be able to find all the details of his book and his next projects and such like. So, yeah. Thanks again to Kieran Mann for the music. Thanks again to Andrew Greaves for production. And we'll see you next week. See you now. Bye-bye.